I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe anthropologist Marcus Hamilton. He is with the Santa Fe Institute, and he is working on a project called Shrinking Horizons, Preserving Humans' Homes. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great, thanks.
Now, this is an interesting project because, among other things, it's a crowdsourcing, crowdfunding project, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But basically, the idea is that there are still remaining on this earth, believe it or not, some people who have not really had any contact with the outer world, in other words, indigenous people living off the land, who are unaware or basically out of contact with modern industrial society.
That's right. I mean, they're obviously very rare now and really occur in two major parts of the world. That's in New Guinea and in the Amazon Basin and a few other isolated spots.
And is the isolation the reason?
Yeah, these are very, very remote areas, and in New Guinea, for example, it's a very rugged and very remote area, and so that breeds isolation. And in the Amazon Basin, it's in the very isolated parts of the Amazon Basin, but it's important to say a lot of these uncontacted groups in the Amazon Basin are somewhat aware of the outside world, and a lot of them have decided, you know, they don't want to participate in the outside world, and that's part of the issue. You know, we're interested in basically conserving these cultures in the ecological and cultural circumstance they wish to be in. So, you know, if they've made that decision, or if there really hasn't been any contact ever over history, you know, it's our job as anthropologists to kind of preserve that cultural diversity, you know, in the manner that they want it to be preserved.
Now, why do we know why they have kind of taken a look at the society outside and say, we want no part of it?
No, we don't. I mean, there's, you know, the level of contact they've had with the outside world is generally probably not direct. So if anything, it will probably be indirect through trade. And a lot of these groups, if they have had direct contact with the outside world, it's been a very unpleasant process because a lot of it's through, you know, deforestation, destruction of habitat, a lot of illegal mining, illegal settling of the indigenous lands. There's direct conflict and warfare, and so you know, a lot of these groups aren't confronted with the benefits of the outside world. A lot of them are, and that's why they decide to acculturate themselves. And again, if these cultures want to do that, that's completely up to them. We're not stopping that. You know, we're not trying to preserve a static equilibrium that makes anthropologists happy. We're just trying to sort of reinforce and conserve the status that they want to be in.
Well, there's also more to it than that. It's not only the status that they want to be in, but what it sounds like is we have a lot to learn from people who are basically not destroying the land that they live on.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. I mean, so this larger project that we're interested in here is looking both at the sort of basic science questions of how do you understand the anthropology of a completely indigenous society, so natural fertility society, subsistence level society. And the other side of it is to understand it's the more applied benefits of, okay, once you have that basic understanding of how these groups make a living, how do you actually conserve their ability to do that in perpetuity?
Now, one of the things that probably those people who aren't anthropologists haven't really thought of is the fact that when anthropologists go in to study a group, the group is changed by the anthropologists.
That's very true, and this can occur on, you know, multiple levels. So when anthropologists go down and work with indigenous groups, they're obviously, you know, extremely careful about what they do. Everything's done under informed consent, so everybody's aware of the studies going on, etc. But that's part of the issue. You know, once you go into a society that behaves in a certain way, you're not sure about, you know, how the presence of an anthropologist might affect the behavior. And the other extreme example of, you know, the problems with interference and contact is disease. So if a indigenous society really hasn't been contacted, especially in the New World, they don't have immunity to very common diseases to us in the developed world, it can cause catastrophic mortality. And that's the history of contact with indigenous societies all over the planet. And that's one of the issues with uncontacted groups now is, you know, leave them to make their own decisions. Don't instigate contact because there's these unavoidable catastrophic medical issues that arise, which are very, very hard to control.
What are some examples of the diseases that we types tend to spread?
Just common flus, measles, just all sort of common European diseases that to us are nothing. They last for a few days. We have built-in immunity, have for probably thousands and thousands of years, but these groups have never been exposed to any of these pathogens, and so they have no immunity.
Right. Now, one of the ways, and that's what this crowdsourcing project is about, is learning about these people without contacting them directly.
Yes, exactly. So this crowdsourcing project is really a pilot study for a larger project that we're working on. And so what we want to do is use the best available technologies to facilitate gathering high quality and high quantity data that allows us to get a really good picture of the ecology of these people, so that we understand over a day, over a week, over a month, over a year, or over a decade, how much land are they actually using to make a living, and then what can you do about ensuring that they have they maintain access to those resources in that land.
Is there, I mean, are you looking at ratios, like you need X number of square miles or what, acres of land per person kind of thing for a group to survive?
So, yeah, exactly that kind of thing. So that exactly, that's where you start off. The basic theory is, you know, X many people, X amount of land, what's the ratio of needed land to the number of people? It's not always a simple linear extrapolation, but then there's complexities that come into it. What kind of environment are they operating in? Is it an open grassland? Is it thick canopy rainforest? That's obviously going to make a lot of difference. Is it the Arctic tundra? Obviously, that's going to make enormous difference if you have to forage across a landscape. And then one of the keys that this kind of study is trying to get at is, how do people negotiate that? So how do they move through their landscapes? Do they use predictable paths? Do they go predictable distances? Do they use the same kind of areas sequentially? And so those are the kind of details we hope to be getting at.
And do they move seasonally?
Yeah, exactly. And if how often do they move? How far do they move? All that kind of information. So this information in general that we're gathering is not unique in anthropology. I mean, people routinely gather this kind of data, but it's very hard, and because basically it requires an individual anthropologist to get funding to go down. And if you're going to track one hunter, for example, as they move across a landscape, you can only do that with one person over a sequence of days, for example. And so you get a snapshot, you get a sample of their ecology. But what we're trying to do is try and do that all at once. So get a large sample size of how individuals are using space and what's the overall picture that we get. And so we think that this kind of approach, if it's successful, could really revolutionize how anthropologists study these groups.
And so what is the technology that you're using that is not, that does not involve a bunch of anthropologists showing up with notebooks?
Yeah, it's a relatively simple GPS device. It's wireless. It's about the size of a cell phone, weighs a little more, probably about a 10-year-old cell phone or something. And the idea is that we want to experiment with ways of how individuals, first of all, can carry this across a landscape, or how they can carry it over the day without it being any trouble, and seeing how well it performs. So we get a large, hopefully a large sample size of these devices, so 10, 12, 15 or something like that, see if they all work. Do they all work consistently? Under what conditions do they work, or do they fail? So under very closed canopy conditions, which is obviously the majority of the Amazon basin, how well do these devices perform?
Because they're sending a signal to what, a satellite?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And they're having to do that through,
So you're basically spying. You're using, like, spy technology.
In a way. I mean, if you were doing... I can see what you mean, yeah. We're at least gathering data and analyzing data. But as I say, it's the same.
But I mean, how do you get them to carry these things around?
Oh, because we're going to be working with a group that is very well known and has been contacted for several years, and UNM, University of New Mexico, has a long-term study with them.
Okay, so this is not the uncontacted groups. This is a group that you would use as a kind of trial?
Exactly. So we're conducting a pilot study with a contacted group called the Ache in Paraguay, that are very used to anthropologists and have been well studied by my colleagues, actually. Myself, I haven't actually been down there. I work with data that comes out of there. So they're all fully aware of what the study will be, you know, willing to participate. And so issues of informed consent, for example, are not going to be an issue down there. They'll be willing to participate in the study, see how well it works. And then the idea is that if we can get this to work, is to scale it up, to use this with other groups, and then eventually it'd be great to work with the purely uncontacted groups. But if that was to happen, I mean, that'd have to be under very, very strict conditions, and it'd be under, we'd have to work with the Brazilian government, for example, that has an agency that looks after indigenous affairs. So none of this is sort of, you know, ad hoc, going into the field and just seeing what works. It's all under very controlled circumstances. So,
but I mean, these uncontacted people who don't really want to have anything to do with anybody else, how do you get them to carry around cell phones?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so one of the ideas is that we could adapt this technology into maybe into tools, for example. And so it's being carried as part of a natural piece of equipment, and it's not being any burden. But it's giving us the data that's going to allow us to, you know, understand their ecology. But so this is the initial stage of what we hope will be a much larger project.
We're talking to anthropologist Marcus Hamilton. How does this relate to the work you're doing here at the Santa Fe Institute?
Well, one of the things that SFI is well known for in the scientific and academic world is developing theory about how complex systems happen, whether they be financial systems, cities, chemical reactions, whatever it happens to be. And so what we're doing here is we're using the same kinds of concepts to understand indigenous societies in a complex environment faced with a lot of external pressures, such as, you know, deforestation, illegal mining, all these kind of things. So what we want to try and do is understand the interactions that affect the demography of these populations and affect the ecology of these populations. And at SFI nowadays, in the last few years, we've kind of developed this approach to trying to quantify social systems in general. So using more rigorous techniques, which are more common to the harder sciences, and apply those to social sciences, now that there's more and more kinds of data available from anthropological studies. And so it fits into that whole sort of paradigm. The main difference in this study is we're not interested in purely sort of theoretical insights. We're interested in getting, you know, understanding the basic ecology of these groups, but also the applied benefits of what that information can mean for the welfare of these populations.
And then how does that translate into their welfare?
Just in terms of preserving, you know, understanding how much area these groups use, how large are these groups, how fast are they growing, for example, how large are those populations likely to get, and so therefore how much land are they going to need preserved.
And then you take that information to the governments and say, here we have scientific data, you have to preserve this.
Yeah, so a lot of that has been done in some ways. So the Brazilian government since the 1960s have been setting up indigenous reserves around uncontacted groups and contacted groups. And they've been very successful in many ways. But we're trying to add a little more sort of rigor to that process of understanding, okay, well, are these areas actually large enough to maintain these populations? And, you know, what can we do about areas of deforestation or pressures on these areas to preserve them in the way that they are currently? Because a large part of these areas are disappearing very fast. And in
right.
some areas of the Amazon Basin, you have these indigenous reserves, which completely deforested around. So they're basically these islands of forest habitat. Obviously in some areas of the Amazon Basin, it's still very intact. And so you kind of want to study the dynamics of that too. How does the fact that they're in an isolated island of habitat affect their long-term prospects?
Exactly, because maybe that island will eventually cut off other animals and species from getting into to their so-called island.
Yeah, exactly, and exactly that. I mean, so it affects their resource structure basically, but it also in indigenous societies, much as it is in modern societies, contact with other social groups is incredibly important to find marriage partners, trading, etc. And if these groups become completely isolated and surrounded essentially by deforested fields, you get isolated from groups, what's known as the overall metapopulation structure, the sort of complex structure of interactions between isolated populations, that breaks down. And once that breaks down, the survival prospects for groups looks quite pretty grim.
It's the same thing that we talk about when we talk about wildlife corridors in on this continent. If you've got two groups of bears that can't get back and forth to each other, each group becomes inbred and they don't survive as well.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very, very similar context, and that's why, so that's a very good example of our approach to studying this kind of human system is really coming more from sort of formal ecology look at or perspective of, how do isolated populations behave? How does it affect their demography? And what does that mean for conservation? That applies to lots of different species. And obviously we're one mammal species.
Now, all this, I mean, just to get back to this point, which I think is important, it is crucial that political entities actually listen to what you guys come up with.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, do they?
Well, there's give and take. So basically, a lot of political decisions are made by individuals and they have particular interests, but hopefully they're informed by science when the science is relevant. And so hopefully, especially with this kind of study where you're looking at the preservation of indigenous societies, and there's already a governmental structure in Brazil, for example, to do that, you'd hope that the more rigorous the information they have available to them, the better decisions they can make. But you can't guarantee that. But I'd just like to add that we aren't policy makers. That's a very specific skill in itself. And so what we're trying to do is basically just develop the science and the data that those people that are skilled at policy can then use to make those arguments and actually affect change.
Marcus Hamilton is an anthropologist. He's at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great. Well, thank you very much.